This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann in Sawyers Bay, Dunedin, and I'm joined from Whakatane by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. I am trying to figure out how to represent time in a thesis.
Oh, what's the context?
Context is that in a conventional thesis, the instructions are nice and simple. Everything's past tense except things that, like, papers that have been produced in the last year or two, because then you can sort of claim them and say, well, this has just happened, but it's only just happened. It's still happening. It's so current. That's why I haven't included it. But in professional practice, almost the contract is broken on that it's the writing you're doing is about the journey of your learning. And so it wants to maintain that journey notion. So we don't have a single point that the thesis sits at. It's one that's got multiple cursors, if you like, the reading cursor, the writing cursor, the cursor of the time when the events that you're writing about happened. And then we've got complicated things like what you did in your thesis, interviewing the shoulders of giants, interviewing the people you are referencing. Well, what time, when does that sit?
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's tricky.
Anyway, that's what I'm working on when I'm not talking to people.
Well, I'm working on my sourdough, so it's all about time as well, but a different kind of time.
Well, the sourdough's time.
Yeah, exactly. It absolutely Remember is that- in its own time.
The book chapter we wrote a while ago about speculative design fiction, and Dave Hursthaus wrote his bit of it from the perspective of Gorse.
Yeah.
And what time frame does that sit in?
Yeah. That's so funny, eh?
Similarly for your sourdough, that sourdough organism is very, very old.
It is.
Your batch of it's quite new, but the actual organism is very old.
It is. And even the other two batches I'm working with every day, one's 150, the other's 135, and they're, you can see the age of them and the way that they behave. It's amazing. Blows me away.
Are they like creaking with walking sticks?
No, they're just the way they grow and the way the flexibility of the dough, the smell of it, the feel of it, the taste of it amazes me.
Right, let's stop talking about sourdough and gorse.
And we're talking about another Sam.
We're talking with another one of your Coming Up For Air episodes.
We are. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce the very friendly and lovely and good thinking Sam Milton. Sam, it is a joy to have you with us today, especially after your really great podcast interview, which we're going to hear shortly. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, and thank you so much for those kind words. Appreciate it so much. And to be fair, I was really enjoying listening about the sourdough. I think we could get back to that if we wanted.
Yes. Kia ora, Sam. Where did you grow up, Sam?
Wellington. So spent pretty much my whole life there until coming down to Otago to study. So, yeah, been based in the same place pretty much my whole life. So it's been quite nice to come down to Dunedin, change of scenery, meet new people, and just really cool experience.
What was it like growing up in Wellington?
It's hard for me to sort of compare it to anything because it kind of just feels a bit bog standard, but I don't know. I enjoyed my childhood. It was very good. I mean, got me into football, and it's probably been the basis of my identity. Like, when I go home, it'll be cool to go see a Wellington Phoenix game. Unfortunately, I go home after the Wellington Phoenix Auckland FC derby, but I'll be watching it here in Dunedin, and that'll be a fantastic game. Might watch it with some of my Auckland mates, and yeah, have the rivalry down here.
You're going to stay loyal to the Phoenix, though.
Oh, 100%. I have to.
So what did you want to be when you grew up?
Just to stay on like my previous topic, I was quite keen on being a footballer, but never really had the skill. I kind of just watched it and thought, oh, maybe I can do that. But I don't have the athleticism to do any of that. So I'll just stick to watching it for now, I think.
So what have you done instead?
So I went to uni, done commerce, majoring in economics and minor in finance. And then that's led me to this fantastic course, the Masters of Sustainable Business, where it's been quite different to my undergraduate, and I've got exposure to new ideas and as new people. So it's been fantastic.
So tell us about the moment where you decided that sustainable business was the direction you were heading.
I have to admit, it wasn't super straightforward. I was sort of at a crossroads at the end of last year. I wasn't too sure what I was going to be doing. And I was sort of doing some investigation on maybe potential jobs or further studies. And then I just saw this on the Otago page, and it just seemed like the right step. Obviously, sustainable business is going to be super important, or it is super important. And I thought that's something I want to be a part of. I want to learn new skills, something that I've never really done before. And yeah, I think it's paying off.
Has sustainability been a thing for you personally before?
I wish I could say yes, but I don't think like outright it's been huge. But then whilst doing this course, I can kind of reflect back on how I've sort of adapted to it, how I've maybe made those considerations in the past, and it's just sort of honing in the idea of sustainability and just solidifying that where I can make those choices or use it in decision making to make a better outcome. Yeah.
Was it talked about much in your economics and finance degree?
Not particularly, no. maybe occasionally in economics, but more just in theory rather than specific things. Yeah.
What would you want the economics and finance departments to be telling their first years about sustainability if you could rewrite the curriculum even a little bit?
Ooh, that's a good question. I wonder if even just couple lectures a semester where you're sort of more focused on sustainability, you're looking at because in finance they do look at ESGs and everything, but maybe in first year it'd be nice if there was a week specialized for it where you focus a bit more on it, so students sort of get that idea earlier on.
It's kind of surprising there isn't a week there already.
Yeah, maybe a couple more weeks even.
So let's take your music choice. What are we having and why?
Viva La Vida by Coldplay, and no huge significance other than I really like that song. It's the top of my Spotify list, and yeah, I like listening to it. Simple as that. It's probably quite a generic choice, but I think for the most part people like it.
Kia ora koutou, nga mihi aroha nui kia koutou, ko tahua hau. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day. Who you are. The triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, and we are still in recovery mode from this global pandemic. For many of us, our health and well-being has been affected. I have the long COVID, the post-viral fatigue, and this has changed my life. I must rest more every day, but I've made peace with this now. It's taken some years, but I have adjusted, and now I am grateful for that opportunity to rest. It offers me the time and the space to process, to connect, to recover, to recalibrate, to reframe, all of those things that are so helpful. And I'm very privileged and very grateful to be able to take that rest around my work and other commitments that I have. I've had to reduce the commitments that I take on, and I have had to reduce my hours at work. But I've been able to find ways to survive, as have we all. And I think we should feel very proud, and I think that we should feel very grateful to still be here together and still be sharing this fascinating path. I know for myself, I've seen great changes in the people around me, and I love this show, and I love how this show is a testament to our capacity as a species to grow and change and evolve and co-evolve and reform worlds together. This is a great skill that we have, a great gift that we have, and it is worth celebrating every day. I know for myself that my greatest point of connection in this life is the living world, the natural world. And the beauty of the living world, the beauty of the wild and untamed natural forces really speaks to my heart and really enlivens and inspires my mind. So I'm fortunate that I could come back here from England, where I went when I was 7. And I returned when I was 18. And I got a job at the aquarium, and it changed my whole life. And ever since then, how long ago is it now? 21 years ago, 20 years ago, 21 years ago, I have frolicked about in the living world with beautiful people of all ages. And inspiring that connection with the living world is my life's work. And I'm grateful for that. It's clear, it's simple, it's straightforward, and it means the most to me. I want us all to have that ongoing relationship, that infinite relationship with all life. And I want us all to find emotional resilience there. As I drive, I'm gazing out over the ocean. And it is calm today, just little ripples forming on the surface. And we know as we go beneath that surface, the water gets calmer and calmer and stiller, just as when we go within ourselves. The surface may be tumultuous, the surface may be rough, but we know within us, in our core, in our heart, there is that peace. There is that infinite and eternal peace of which we are made, that is of our essence. And I'm grateful for that peace. So, it's always a great pleasure and privilege to speak with you. And I hope that in these times of recovery and change, you're able to find that peace within you all. And a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. And I'll talk with you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Sam Milton.
Sam, your interview with Jacopi was really interesting. What would you like to tell us? What would you like to tell us about it?
I think so. When I first was looking for someone to interview, I was initially thinking, who could I just interview? Because it'd be an amazing conversation, someone who's very kind. And that's what I got with Jacopi. I was like initially just wanting to speak to him because he came into one of our classes, and he's an absolutely lovely guy. So it was nice just being able to spend like 30-35 minutes getting to know him. But also I was fortunate enough to ask questions about his thesis, so 50 years of independence, indigenous perception on sustainable land development in Fiji. And I think the main ideas that I took away from it was just the importance on indigenous knowledge, especially in his context in Fiji, and just the importance of sort of implementing that into making and to get more sustainable outcomes. it was very important. We talked about sort of the different islands cooperating to specialize in different goods or services for economic prosperity and food security. We also discussed about how in some of his projects, he does a very good job at engaging with youth to get them involved. And I think lots of what he talks about is just listening to the local people and what they want, what they feel is best, and just the importance of listening to everyone. And that's how you get the most equitable and sustainable outcomes. But yeah, he's a very entertaining man, and I very much enjoyed speaking with him.
And the listeners will enjoy the interview. I really appreciated the way that you just did a really magic job of it. So,
oh, thank you so much.
That was so good. And I know that when Jacopi hears it, he will feel really proud of this little collaboration that you guys had together as well.
Oh, thank you. I hope so.
Welcome back to the Blowing Bubbles podcast. I'm your guest host, Sam Milton. We've got an exciting episode today as I'm honoured to sit down with Jacopi Mayono, where he provides us crucial insights into sustainable development in the Pacific. After writing his doctoral thesis, 50 Years of Independence, Indigenous Perception on Sustainable Development, Jacopi discusses the challenges, triumphs, and day-to-day life in the Pacific. In this discussion, I will be leaning on the works by Dori Pate's academic article, Catalyzing Sustainable Development Through Regional Food System Governance. The inspiration for this topic was from Lani Kavaloko, writer of Sustainable Development in the Pacific. You've heard enough from me. I think we should get right into it and hear from the real expert. I'm honored to be joined by Jacopi Mayono. Could you explain a little bit about yourself?
So my name is Jacopi Ramala Mayono. I am from a very small island on the northern tip of Fiji.
So I've got a few sort of quick fire questions just designed for the listeners to get a better idea of who you are.
Yeah.
So starting off, you said where you grew up. How do you think that affected who you became?
I think that is, I would say, the origin of my personal drive.
Yeah.
Because I come from such a very small island and so remote. And I bring that with me when I move from the island, and everywhere I go, I have to be appreciative of what I have, because some of the things that we have here is hard to get there. But also at the same time, those lessons that I was taught at a very early age stays with me. And that was the foundation of my, my upbringing. One of the important pillars of who I am is understanding my identity, understanding where I come from and what is my role in this space.
That's a fantastic answer. And yeah, you're doing such a good job at showing your culture and showing the problems in the Pacific through your work. On a different note, if you were to have a dinner party and you could invite three guests, dead or alive, who would you invite and why?
I think Nelson Mandela will be up there, probably Jesus.
Yeah, fair enough. he's good at dinner parties.
And I would say Barack Obama.
Much better than what I would have said. What's one of the biggest challenges in your life?
I guess the biggest challenge is just the preconcept idea that I'm not good enough in this space. For us in Fiji, is a colonial mindset.
Yeah.
You know, we read this, we learn this in school. The history was told to us from a different perspective.
And right.
We never really kind of grips the idea of why things are done in a certain way. So as you progress through life, you kind of start to slowly understand why things are the way they are. And the perception that people think of us as specific is that we're just only good at sports and then we're not good at other stuff. Which is a constant thing in the back of my mind. You're not good enough. You're not good enough. You're not good enough in this space. It's how to silence those outside voice and just believing in you that I own this, man.
Yeah.
I can do this.
Do you think this challenge motivates you? It sort of gives you that extra drive?
Yeah, hard. Yeah. And also at the same time, that is like, you need to shut it down. I usually I do this in rugby. When I was playing rugby, before every game, I usually, in the change room, I can do this, I can do this. And I still do that before I go to my class. Sometimes I'm about to present on something that I'm not really comfortable with, and then all these fears start coming out. And then I just keep saying to my mind, you're good enough.
Who do you think is the most influential person in your life, and how did they impact you?
I think my grandfather at a very early age, and his message was simple. In the island, you have to plant a crop in a day, because on the same day the next year, you're going to eat from that same crop.
That's an amazing message. I don't know, that's so cool. That sort of moves us on to our next sort of topic of sustainability. What is sustainability to you, and how did you first get involved?
Well, I heard about sustainability at my 300 level when I was nearly finishing my degree. And then when I was sitting in that classroom, everything the lecturer was talking about resonated with me, because this is our way of life. Sustainability, from where I come from, is a way of being. You go and you get just whatever you needed, and then you come back, and then you make sure that you plant something so that you can live from the next day. We live. Sustainability, it's the way we do things. It's embodied through our culture, through our protocols, and the way we do life.
Yeah, that's a wonderful idea, because I think that is a problem where people do separate sustainability from work and their lives, where it's only incorporating sustainability when they can profit off of it.
Yeah.
You've had such an amazing contribution to sustainable factors. You were doing a development project on Shikopia Island?
Shikopia Island.
Yeah. Looking back at your rural sustainable development project there, what were the standout factors that contributed to its success?
It's about understanding the two worlds. When we come from an organization perspective, and then when you go to a social setting, those are very two different priorities. And most of the time, they contradict each other. So for the project to be accepted at both end, the people that give me the funding, it's an organization, they got funding criteria, they got things, system KPIs to complete, and the people in the village, they have different ways of doing things. So these two will always clash, but you need to be able to navigate those two worlds. I think one of the most, the reason why it was successful is I learned to be humble. Not to treat the people in the village as, oh, these people don't know anything. In fact, they know more about sustainability in their context than me. Always make sure that you bring their knowledge system with what you learn and find the best way in the middle to implement the project.
Nice. Well, so what were the outcomes of the sustainable project?
So far, we have finished one that we built a house, a shed in the jetty. And then we did some tree planting. We used to plant some pine trees. And then now we are installing almost 17 water tank, water security project, harvesting rainwater. And then last month, we installed a solar panel and a few freezer to store their fish, so they can send it to the mainland to sell. The whole idea is about sustainable livelihood. For them, it's not about profit. It's just making sure that they fulfill some of their basic needs.
I was looking at some other literature as well, and they talk about the importance of acting in a group, because if you're working as an individual, the actions just aren't going to be as successful. Mm-hmm. And that's why you engaged quite a lot with youth. How did you manage to inspire the young people there?
I figured out that I have a lot of responsibility, and these people are looking up to me and they are looking for direction. They have the human resource. They have the people on the ground. All they need is some kind of direction. And so we start talking about, what do you want to see the island in the next 10 years? So then they can start visualizing, oh, we want a jetty. Oh, we want every house here to have a water tank. And then you can start see the smile in their face.
That's amazing.
Motivate them that way, that the only thing we can do this is through youth and collectivism.
Looking at your thesis, how would you sell it to the listener and get them more interested into reading it?
Yeah, I think the definition of sustainability is one of the key findings in my thesis. The whole world needs to understand. And this idea that in order for sustainability to work, we have to be part of the sustainability system. The whole system need to embrace sustainability at a very personal level.
From your time researching your thesis, are there any stories that would offer insight into sustainability issues into the Pacific?
In Fiji, most of those people live sustainably at a very small scale. And it's how do we frame that and kind of maybe just tell them again, actually, what you're doing is good. And then maybe, you know, because the whole world is going around now, is changing. You know, we're going through capitalistic system of extraction and profit maximization this way. And now we are coming back to try and figure out the indigenous way of doing things. For most of them, they are, okay, we want to do the way the outside world is doing. So now we are going back and tell them, no, actually, go back to the way you have done this before.
Yeah.
Because this is the best way. And that's why everybody studying sustainability in this space are coming back to some of this indigenous knowledge, because all this modern knowledge is not working.
Loads of countries will be looking at Fiji and wanting to incorporate lots of their core values. And that gets me on to my next point. How similar are sustainability issues in the Pacific compared with the Western world?
I think in the Western world, we are very good in contextualizing it, in looking at it and understanding, okay, these are system that is happening. In the Pacific, what is different is they are doing it because that's how they have been doing it, and they have seen result and it's helping them, but they are not very good in capturing it and conceptualizing it so that you can see what they're doing is good. But when you tell them, and they just, oh, this is how we do it. And then you can say, okay, see what you're doing here. It's helping this. And all these things are connected. And they're going to say, okay, we kind of knew that.
Could you explain how the indigenous people of Fiji define and practice sustainable land development within the framework of Vanua ecology?
Yeah. So I think Vanua ecology is this idea that in the land as defined in the modern context is the physical space you can see. Land is translated in Fijian is Vanua. And that is everything in the land, including the people on the land.
Yeah.
The identity that person bring on the land. The culture that people are using to survive on the land. So these are the added layer into that understanding of land. That is where things get complicated for some people when they start reading. And in my thesis, it breaks it down into components so that people can start to understand. Because when you talk about that in the Fijian culture, they will mention all these different things. And for you to kind of figure out, okay, he's talking about the mountain. That's a physical characteristic of it. He's talking about identity that talks about his connection to the land. So all this is kind of in the space of Vanua.
From lots of the literature, it's highlighted governance challenges, especially in Fiji with colonization. How have the indigenous people managed sustainability with the contrasting viewpoints of the government of the sort of colonial relationship?
That's a good question, because I think the political ecology in Fiji, it's related to the evolution of land tenure, the laws that, to some extent, most of the indigenous people have a very little control of the land law and the land tenure system that are happening in Fiji. But one thing I found out from my thesis was after independent, the indigenous Fijian were not really sure what's the big plan for them in terms of land and sustainability. All they were focusing on is just independence.
That's a really good point, because lots of the literature was talking about how traditional leadership was kind of eroded from these practices.
Yeah,
that's a really important point. In the literature, it discussed the problem of land development, but particularly food system governance.
Yeah. Mm.
And it seems that food system governance in the Pacific Island is heavily focused on economic outcomes, and that's often at the expense of social and environmental considerations. Did you find that in Fiji in your research?
I think if you go to most of the villages, they have a little garden. They have garden. So also when you look at my thesis, it talks about the three aspects of how indigenous Fijian use the land. It talks about the Yavutu, which means the original place of inhabitants where they build their house. And then it talks about Itete, the garden. That's where they sustain themselves from. But the interesting fact is before colonization, indigenous Fijian do not do agriculture. Everything was in the forest. They go and forge, and it's a hunting and gathering system. So now they have this system, and there are some families, they still rely on hunting and gathering. So when the yam season comes, they go in the mountain and they just look at the trees and they see some brown leaves and orange one. They knew, oh, there is a ripe yam, so they can go and harvest. And what they do is they harvest the yam, they took out what they need, and they cut the yam and they put it back. and they know next year they will be harvesting the same year. While some of them, they have the modern way of agriculture. They started to plant yam. They will have rows and rows of yams planted and be looked after, well-maintained. And during harvest time, they go and harvest from their yam. So in terms of food supply, most of them are pretty well off. One of my friends telling me, oh man, people in the island, all they work for every day is to provide 3 meal on the table. But if you think about here, we go to work every day for 8 hours, and then we use all that money to buy food. In the island, they don't go for and work for 8 hours, but rather they go and look at their garden, or they go hunting and gathering to provide that 3 meal.
And that's quite common for all Pacific Island nations.
Yes. Yeah. Especially in Fiji, yeah.
Yeah. Beyond Fiji, what lessons can other Pacific nations learn from Fiji's experience with sustainable land development and indigenous rights?
It goes back to leadership. Good governance, good leaders, well-defined goals, good people in place, so that we have a coordinated system on how you want to do well. Say, for example, if you want to become the best supplier in kava in Fiji. Leaders started to embrace this idea, because when you talk about identity, then Fiji can identify themselves as, okay, we are the best.
Yes.
We are the best. And if we call this concept of identity and all the Idabuti, all this that I mentioned, at the government level, we can start doing that, so that they can be said, okay, Fiji can be the breadbasket for cassava. And then so the government should invest in that. At the moment, there's nothing. There's so many little things and so many other people doing lots of different things, but there's no coordinated effort to drive Fiji into one direction.
And there's that scope for them to be those sort of pioneers of sustainability, because they've done it before. I was reading an article by the Deputy Prime Minister of Tonga between 1991 and 2000, and he suggested that Pacific cultures sort of possess the resilience and adaptability, and that can be harnessed to create sustainable development pathways. How do you think your findings can shape future policies in Fiji?
We really need to kind of really sit down and start defining what the next 50 years will look like. For the indigenous people, they need to come out and articulate that this is what we want. We want a Fiji that is like this. And so far, that hasn't really been obvious there. In terms of sustainable land development, you know, how do we want to see the distribution of land? How do we want to see the utilization of land so that every citizen of Fiji can benefit from the use of land? Political aspiration, all this has kind of muddied the water on the reality, on the purpose of livelihood and the use of land. Because until we unpack that and remove all the politics, the real thing behind that is livelihood.
What is your vision for the future of sustainable development in the Pacific, and what hopes do you have for the region's progress in coming years?
The Pacific is a region that they need to start coordinating on who should be specializing in what. We cannot all be fishermen, because then if Fiji is doing well in producing cassava or yams, then we can get Tonga to do something else.
And economically, that just makes sense, giving countries comparative advantages. What you can do best. I think that sounds fantastic. Yeah. What makes you feel positive about the future of sustainability?
I think the people, because if you talk about culture, you talk about identity and all these things, if you are removing the people from the equation, then everything is void.
Mm.
When you go to the village and you see people facing the effect of climate change, they're still there. And that is the hopeful things.
Yeah.
You know? A lot of people are migrating, are moving here and there, and that is to be expected. But there are some people that are staying. You know, we can spend a lot of energy in doing everything, any development or whatever we do. Development is supposed to be for people.
Well, yeah, it's all on us to make that difference. You've been so fantastic. I appreciate your time so much. And I think everyone should go read your thesis. I think they'll learn loads. What's coming up next for you?
I'm teaching at the moment. I've got a lecturer's position here at the management department.
Nice.
I think research in the Pacific, that will be the go-to for me, around the space of land development, livelihood, and indigenous methodology, knowledge system on how that can be enhanced and be used in the modern context.
I think that's super exciting, and I'm looking forward to keeping up with it. Thank you so much for the interview. It's been fantastic. It's been Sam Milton and Jacopi, and thanks for listening to the Blowing Bubbles podcast.
Sam, when you think about the interview, what was your big personal takeaway from it?
Ooh, good question. I think just everything I felt was very important, but I think, as I said before, just sort of the importance of listening to everyone. Just everyone's got their own unique perspective, and everything, every perspective is relevant and credible, and you just need to take them on board, because it takes all sorts to make a world, and yeah, just so much more exciting being able to actually listen to everyone and using their ideas, because otherwise we wouldn't really have any innovation or anything. Yeah, I think that was the main thing I took away from it.
It's funny, whenever we talk to students who have been through the sustainable program, you all have a similar kind of view of things where everybody's voice matters. And I don't know that I've ever encountered that before in other groups. I've been in education for a long time, and it's never been like the theme. But in this program, it's definitely the theme. You all have that. What do you think does that? Is it because you had it, you all had it, and it brought you in, or is it something that you've all developed along the way?
I didn't realise that. That's a really interesting point. Maybe it is because like everyone in the course comes from different backgrounds. So we've sort of been exposed to like people from everywhere. So everywhere, every age group. Every belief system, so maybe we've just sort of been I don't know what the right phrase is, but we've just seen that that's really important, being able to listen to one another and everything on board. But that's a very interesting thing. I think
through doing these interviews that I really noticed it, and there's a like an advanced critical thinking that you guys had, that you all develop. Or that you all started the project with. That's what I need to know, you know. Is it a before or is it an after thing? But if you think about the way that you think, which is unique in itself, because it's uniquely you, but also informed by all of these, by your respect for the voice of others, if you were going to create the perfect job for you for the future, what is that job?
Oh, I don't know. I'd be searching for it. I think just something where I get to engage with people from all walks of life. I think that would be amazing. I don't know what the job would look like or what sector it would be in, but I think, that would be the ideal job for me.
Is there a sector that does have some sort of appeal, though? You got a vague kind of direction?
So I think for me, at least initially, I'm really keen on doing private sector and maybe in the future government work, but just also being able to sort of utilize the things I've learned through this course and sort of implement it into private sector jobs, and have that little bit of a differential and maybe belief system or whatnot, just to maybe spark some change
And if there was a change that you could bring about now, what would that look like?
I think just for everyone to be a little bit more sort of considerate of other people's viewpoints, just if we all start to listen a bit more to one another, I think that's where we get success. That's where we get real change from, or positive change at least. Just being able to listen to people's viewpoints and what they want, what they see. And I think that's how we get a more sort of cohesive society that sort of benefits from one another.
I would have to agree with you, and I spent a lot of time pondering that lack of engagement that has got real authentic engagement, honest conversations about things, and I worry about the generation that's coming up behind you and their level of frustration that I can see when that's absent. So growing up in Wellington, that's the heart of politics for Aotearoa. Were you interested in that side of things, the policy and the political side of this kind of space?
When I was younger, unfortunately not. I kind of just a bit oblivious, sort of just all going on in the background. Just did my own thing. Yeah, and I suppose, yeah, it's quite ironic that there's all that going on. And no, I just didn't think about it. I was a bit ignorant, but yeah.
No, you were busy playing football.
Exactly.
You can't do all the things, hey?
Yeah, I'd have too much on my plate.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
I think just in essence, it's just about sort of maintaining or not, you know, fulfilling your needs without jeopardizing the needs of future generations, sort of that nice balance between economic prosperity and the health of the environment, and just recognizing the relationship between the present and the future.
Bringing it back to sourdough, how do we talk about in the age of Muira sourdough, how do we talk about a future which is more than the next quarterly balance sheet? How do we actually shift the kind of the finance and the economics and whatever to, or maybe those already are, but the focus of business seems quite short.
Yeah, that's an amazing question. Yeah, I suppose it is just adopting a more long-term mindset, just rather than thinking about the next quarter or the next year, just using different metrics that are more long-term, where you're thinking what's our business going to be like in 10 years, what's the things that we're interacting with going to be like in the next 20, 25 years? Are we halting it? Are we damaging it? How can we ensure the long-term viability of our operations? I think that's an important metric, so that future generations can also enjoy the whatever business it is, and maintain it, just keep it going.
The difficulty is that if you apply any sort of discount rate, as soon as you're out to any sort of longish term time frame, then you calculate it back to net value and it's nothing.
Yeah, true. I suppose, the NPV equation says no to that. But yeah, it'd be interesting developing something else. I suppose that's the between balancing things like the NPV and long-term sustainability.
And perhaps why people are just talking past each other, that they've got models that just, this, when you follow to each model to its end point, they're not on the same planet.
Exactly.
So what are you doing your thesis on?
So I need to hone it in a bit, but I'm sort of using my interest in economics and sustainability. So I'm looking at the sort of different emissions the change in carbon emissions from trade deals, from international trade deals. So looking at sort of patterns, whether trade deals with specific information about incorporating the environment in it, whether those trade deals actually do minimize emissions, or whether that's not the case, whether it's just sort of an extra in the document and then they're not really fulfilling those agreements. So I'm looking into that. Just starting it at the moment. So it's going to be a very exciting summer looking into that. It's going to be interesting, and I'm sure at some points it's going to be a bit stressful, but I'm looking forward to the final results, and I hope it's good, but I'm not sure what the final results will be.
It's always difficult to unpick because it's so complicated, all that sort of non-tariff barrier stuff and do countries really take this sort of stuff seriously, and then particularly places like America just saying, well, there's no point us doing anything because look at China.
So look at a range of trade deals, I reckon, and compare them, see maybe what countries are holding up to their agreement a bit more than others, and hopefully there's some good results.
Best of luck to you on that. I have some questions.
Thank you very much.
I have some questions to end the show. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
That's a hard question. I think, honestly, just coming down to Dunedin and meeting new people, I think just sort of being out of my comfort zone, going into halls with 150 new people, just being able to make those connections and sort of meet people. I think that's been such a success, just taking myself out from sort of the really easy comfort of just being at home with the people I know, and then being dropped in a place where I know no one, and just being able to make those connections. Yeah, I think that's a massive success.
What's your superpower?
My superpower? If I could have a superpower, or my,
if you say something like flying, I'm going to say that's interesting, but what's your real one? So you could go both ways.
Oh, right. My superpower. I think my manners. I think I've got pretty good manners. I don't know. We'll go with that. I think I've got some compliments on my manners before, so I'll take that, I think.
I think we have done, what are we on, show 442? I don't think anybody has ever said their manners.
Not ever. You are the very first one, and I would have to agree with you. Gosh, everybody should have said that, eh? Well, not everyone's got good manners, but it should be a superpower.
It's certainly, the point of asking that question is because everybody can learn those sorts of things. They're not real superpowers. They're not laser eyes, and they're not flying. So if we can figure out what it is that people are doing, then we can bottle that. We can focus on developing those things. So that is a great answer.
Thank you. What's the common answer? What's the most common answer for that?
I don't know.
Probably listening.
Listening. Oh, nice. That's important.
Yeah. I don't
optimism.
Know.
Optimism. Yes. We hear optimism a lot, being very optimistic and positive and all those kind of things. But manners actually really matter.
Yeah.
Like that's because that's about how you treat other people. So if I was your mum, I'd be so proud of you for saying that. So if your mum gets so to much. Listen to this, good work, mum.
I'll tell her.
So do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Not really, especially. I think that would be something that would be a good thing to do. I think sometimes I'm a bit lazy, which isn't great, so I just need to get rid of that. And yeah, maybe that's something for me to aspire to.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
I don't know. it's just being on time for things, making sure I've got things to do, commitments, so that I'm not letting anyone down, I think.
What's the biggest challenge or opportunity that you're looking forward to?
Outside of work or academia, I'm going to Europe with a few of my mates soon, and I think that's going to be a challenge, not getting stressed over some, like 40-hour flights. And yeah, I think that's going to be such a fantastic opportunity to see different cultures and whatnot. But it's going to also be a challenge not getting annoyed with my mates and them not getting annoyed with me, I reckon.
Are you going to go to some games?
Yeah, that's the goal. I think that was the main purpose of going in the first place.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I reckon watch the film About Time. I think that's got the most amazing message. It's probably not the greatest advice, but it's such a fantastic film as well. So definitely worth the 2 hours or whatnot of time taken out to watch it.
That seems like pretty good advice. So I know I've never seen it, so now I'm going to, and I'll look forward to reporting back on that.
Please do.
Sam, I just have to say that, you know, like, it, you know, teaching is the joy of my life, and every now and then, you know, we get to, as educators, we get to hang out with some pretty extraordinary people, and you're right up there on my list.
It's been a real joy to spend time
with you in the teaching space, and you know, you've seen the way that Joe and I run the class is all about. You guys do as much teaching as we do, and you've just got such a beautiful way of doing that. So hopefully your future involves some teaching as well, in some form or another. And whatever you do, I'm certain that it will be, you will make a difference with your practice. And I look forward to seeing what you go off to in the future. And good luck with your thesis. I think it's a actually worthwhile bit of research, that. So well done. And good luck with Europe.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the podcast as well. It's been such an amazing opportunity.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going out to Number 8 Wireless, Phoenix Rising.
I feel it burn inside of me, something coming alive in me. I feel it starting to rise in me, Phoenix. In blackened ashes spread your wings, flames of yellow in the winds, upon the skies of Wellington, Phoenix.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytech. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. Follow us on Facebook. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. I was joined today by Moira Karatai and Sam Milton, who brought us his episode of Coming Up For Air. That was Blowing Bubbles. I'm Samuel Mann. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mā te wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.